Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Governor Kathy Hochul signed the Climate Change Superfund Act into law, making New York the second state in the country to hold fossil fuel companies responsible for climate impacts. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
The Climate Superfund law, signed by the Democrat the day after Christmas, establishes a climate change adaptation cost recovery program intended to raise $75 billion over 25 years from gas and oil companies blamed for contributing to climate impacts like flooding and severe heat. Environmental advocates and state legislators alike hailed the development. Third Act Upstate New York climate activist Michael Richardson says the science supporting the law is clear.
The production and burning of fossil fuel is the primary cause of the climate disruption that we're suffering from. With the signing of this Climate Change Superfund Act, which might want to be called the Taxpayer Relief Act, big oil will at long last be held accountable for the damage they sow upon our communities. And they cannot continue to make exorbitant profits, which they've been making over the past few years, by not paying for the destructive consequences.
State Assemblymember John McDonald of the 108th District, a Democrat, expects court challenges.
People can be happy about it today, and you know, I supported it, and who knows, hopefully it'll be successful. But like anything else, I also think it's going to be subject to years and years of litigation, which still puts us in this very difficult spot that we need to make positive and accurate changes to recognize that the climate is changing. In the same token, we need to be mindful of the fact that we need to make sure that these changes don't have a negative adverse impact on the average family's household. If anything has been learned in the last several years, but particularly the last election, affordability is first and foremost in people's minds.
The American Petroleum Institute responded to a request for comment by email, stating, "This type of legislation represents nothing more than a punitive new fee on American energy, and we are evaluating our options moving forward." In May, Vermont became the first state with such a law. Elena Mihaly is the vice president for the Conservation Law Foundation of Vermont.
We are thrilled that New York is now an ally with Vermont in enacting this kind of climate accountability legislation to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable for their fair share in the cost of climate pollution to the states of Vermont and New York. And we actually have a preview of what the American Petroleum Institute's concerns are with the law, because they filed comments in the New York and Vermont legislatures during the adoption of both of the laws that kind of laid out what they felt was either unconstitutional or other concerns with the law. And in Vermont, we had the benefit of that to help make sure that we shaped the law to be defensible to all of those concerns. So we feel very confident about the defensibility of the law, and we are moving forward.
Blair Horner is with the New York Public Interest Research Group.
I think there'll be a bunch of other states that are going to follow what New York does, because the staggering costs of climate change are not going away. And there's two choices. Either the taxpayers pay for it, or the oil companies pay for it. We think it should be the oil companies.
Again, Richardson.
As the next legislative session begins here in January, we need to move beyond the incrementalism that has happened from the legislature and the governor in funding and implementing our landmark Climate Act. We have all the knowledge and tools to transition this New York State economy from fossil fuels to renewables. all that is needed is, quite candidly, the political courage and the political will. Now, that's been demonstrated after 2 years of effort on this climate change Superfund bill. And it is landmark in the sense that there are now four other states that are queued up to follow the lead from Vermont and New York.
Hochul said lawmakers agreed to several changes to address implementation and operational concerns, including giving the State Department of Environmental Conservation additional time to create the program.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Blair Horner, now the senior policy advisor for NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair began by talking about how pleased he and NYPIRG are about Governor Hochul signing the Climate Change Superfund Act.
One of the big issues that both Vermont and New York worked on was to create something called the Climate Change Superfund Act, which is to make the world's largest oil companies at least partially responsible for the costs of climate damages. Vermont passed a bill similar to New York's in June and was approved with the acquiescence of Governor Phil Scott. And this past week in New York, the governor of New York, Governor Kathy Hochul, signed the New York version of the legislation into law. And so both of those are really ways to reduce the taxpayer burden for climate change, because those costs will be enormous. In Vermont, of course, their state capital, Montpelier, has been flooded 2 years in a row. And it's, you know, climate change is not going to get any better anytime soon. And that means more intense storms, more heat, worse air quality, and rising sea levels in New York, not so much a big deal in Vermont, where there's going to be billions and billions of dollars in damages until these type of laws pass. The taxpayer is 100% on the hook in both states now. Some of those costs, a significant portion of those costs, will be shifted to the oil companies.
Yeah, well, the issue of climate is huge, obviously. We have a bond act. We have this new law now, the Superfund Act. But the arguments from the other side that attempted to derail the signing of this legislation center around things like, we don't put out the percentage of emissions that really impacts anyone, the cost will be passed on to consumers, and other such arguments. And obviously, all politicians look at this under a political lens, Blair. What does this all mean in your crystal ball looking forward, for example, for Governor Kathy Hochul? Is this a good political move?
Well, I mean, New York is not Texas, so there's not a gigantic oil industry, right? I mean, our view is that it's a hugely popular. I mean, we've had some polling done which shows that that's true, that the vast majority of New Yorkers, it doesn't matter what party affiliation, believe that the polluters should pay. It shouldn't just be the cost solely borne by the taxpayer. And in fairness to the taxpayer, even though we benefited, of course, from fossil fuel-powered economy, the industry has known for decades that the burning of fossil fuels was going to heat up the planet. And if you heated up the planet, you're going to have all sorts of problems, which is exactly what's happening. And instead of telling people about it and helping to figure out, well, what do we do worldwide? They've done everything they can, and they still do, to block measures to come up with a green grid, to come up with measures to shift away from the reliance on fossil fuels, because they're more interested in their bottom line. And so, okay, that that's the way they're going to behave. Well, let's take some of their bottom line and offset the cost to taxpayers. In New York, over the next 25 years, New York taxpayers will save $75 billion. And you're right that part of the argument was, well, won't these costs be passed on to the public? The answer is no. Economists have looked at this concluded that just since it's a worldwide commodity, you just can't shift the cost. It's not a carbon tax the way this is designed. And so the public won't. But even if they did, right now you're completely on the hook, the taxpayers, 100% of the cost. And even if the oil companies figure out some nefarious way to shift the cost, you're still on the hook for 100% of the cost. You can't be on the hook for more than 100% of the cost. And so it just from our perspective, made sense to roll the dice, particularly when economists agreed that just by the way it's designed, the cost will not be passed on to the public. Instead of spending $150 or $200 billion on climate damages out of the taxpayer pocket, it'll be that number minus $75 billion. So we think it makes sense from a taxpayer perspective. And of course, we think it makes sense from a fairness perspective. Why should the public have to eat the entire cost of roads being washed out, tornadoes touching down, you know, people having to endure hotter temperatures when the oil companies are fabulously profitable and they're making profits because they are doing everything they can to make the atmosphere worse?
That's Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York State ranks last in the nation for delivery of early intervention services, therapy for babies and toddlers with developmental delays. But advocates say things have gotten a lot worse in just the last few months after the launch of a new software system. They say it's making it harder for therapists to get paid and even harder for children to get therapy. The New York Public News Network's Amy Feireisel has more.
Financially, this fall has been really stressful for Lacey Schweigert.
Like, I had no money. Like, I didn't know if I was going to be able to even have a Thanksgiving meal with my children.
But Schweigert didn't have a medical crisis or get laid off from work. She's a special education instructor, and she has been working, providing therapy to babies with developmental delays in Albany and the Capital Region. She just hasn't been getting paid.
I'm not getting paid consistently, and I'm not getting fully paid. I haven't paid my rent this month because I only had enough for half of it.
Schweigert is one of thousands of early intervention providers who've been struggling since October 15th. That's when New York State launched a new software system to manage early intervention. But it's been slow, glitchy, and in some cases, non-functional.
And so this is all just lots and lots of extra time, and therapists are having to work late into the evening and weekends and not getting help or relief from it.
Rebecca Kelly is the early intervention manager for Lewis County. She says in the new software, tasks that used to take 15 minutes now take hours, and there's no way to get help.
I've had my own service coordinators with the county waiting 2 hours plus for a phone call. And then when someone answers, they're not even able to help you. So then they have to put in a ticket.
What's frustrating for Kelly is that the new software, EI Hub, has been in the works for 4 years. And in its testing, Kelly says providers told the state and the company that made it, called Public Consulting Group, or PCG, that the software didn't work.
And that's really unfortunate because we all could sort of see the writing on the wall with how this was going to play out, which then translates to down the road, a domino effect for our children and getting services in a world where we already have a significant number of kids on the wait list in the North Country.
I put in requests for comment to the offices of PCG, Governor Kathy Hochul, and the state's Bureau for Early Intervention. Just the last responded via a written statement. It said it was critical that the state move to new software because the old system from 2013 was vulnerable to security and safety concerns. At a meeting in Albany last week, PCG project manager Lauren Zielinski said the company has been making improvements to EI Hub since its launch.
And we're committed to keeping communication as transparent as possible with all stakeholders. And again, we look at you as partners when we hear your feedback.
But the problem and mounting frustration from providers is a lot bigger than just glitchy software. New York State ranks 50th, as in last, in the United States for fulfillment of early intervention services. For years now, there's been a shortage of therapists and long wait lists for nearly every county in the state.
It's a repeated pattern for New York State to treat providers poorly, and then we don't have providers.
Tracy Harris runs a therapy agency in Watertown in Jefferson County and has been working in early intervention for 3 decades. She says the biggest issue is pay. You see, early intervention providers work as independent contractors, and they're paid according to fixed rates set by New York. Those rates haven't changed since 1994.
Nowhere else in the state would workers work where they weren't getting incremental increases with costs of living and expenses.
Harris says early intervention therapists have been leaving the field for decades now, seeking private work or jobs in K-12 schools where they can expect raises, a pension, health care. She says that's why the launch of a non-functional billing system feels like such a slap in the face. It's why she started advocating and trying to organize with other providers.
And we really need to push the lawmakers and our governor to do something so that this program, which is so critical, I mean, again, it's the most vulnerable children that we have across the state, can be successful.
Andrew Cassini, a Rochester-based occupational therapist, is another provider-turned-advocate. He started a Facebook group for therapists to troubleshoot their issues with EI Hub.
But it's unreal that professionals need to go to a Facebook group to achieve help to do their jobs when PCG was awarded $53 million.
Cassini is referring to the state contract PCG was awarded in 2020. He and others are questioning why New York State hired PCG in the first place.
They have such a terrible record in other states that anybody could Google.
Here's a few cases. In 2017, PCG started providing early intervention software for the state of New Jersey with very similar rollout problems and providers not getting paid. That same year, the company was sued for systematically denying overtime pay to Pennsylvania home care workers. In 2018, Mississippi's Department of Education abandoned a $5.5 million special education software contract with PCG. This is all public record, and Cassini says he doesn't understand why New York chose the company.
It's unfathomable that this history of PCG was unknown to the New York State Department of Health.
The state says PCG was selected after it was the, quote, sole vendor to submit a proposal, end quote. At the Albany meeting last week, PCG spokesperson Rob Lillipop asked for patience.
I ask, you know, providers to stick with us. It's important.
But patience is wearing thin. A Change.org petition decrying the EI Hub rollout and asking for Governor Hochul to intervene has over 13,000 signatures. There's been no response. Several advocates I spoke with say they're calling on the U.S. Department of Education for a federal investigation into New York hiring PCG. Tracy Harris, the early intervention provider in Watertown, says while EI Hub is making therapists' lives a nightmare, it's children who will really pay the price.
It's not children with mild delays. It's children with severe disabilities and diagnoses, and they need their services. These strategies that we give them when they're really young can help them develop all the way through.
When babies and toddlers don't get that help, Harris says they go into school with much bigger issues that take a lot more work to address. Shortly after I spoke with the therapist in Albany, Lacey Schweigert, she was told the rest of her unpaid claims since October 15th would be pushed through. She said she was grateful, but it left her wondering, what about the claims she put in next week?
The New York Public News Network's Amy Feiereisel. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This next story discusses suicide and lasts about 4 minutes. Farmers are at a much higher risk of dying by suicide than the general public. A free course through Cornell University is teaching people how to support their rural neighbors during mental health challenges. The New York Public News Network's Catherine Wheeler has more.
Farming might be an idealistic profession for some, being outside, working with animals, growing food for our communities.
A lot of people think that farming is a wonderful way of life, and they want to jump right in and take it on. It's one of the most stressful jobs a person can have.
That's Becky Wiseman. She's a licensed clinical social worker who works with New York FarmNet. That's a program that helps farmers with their businesses and personal challenges related to their farms. Wiseman says farming can be a double whammy for mental health challenges. First, the job has a lot of stressors. Long days working alone, an ever-changing economy, the fickleness of caring for plants and livestock in unpredictable weather. And on top of that, rural communities often lack robust mental health care services.
Research has shown that rural communities have approximately 65% higher rate of suicide in their population compared to urban areas.
According to the National Rural Health Association, the suicide rate for farmers is nearly 3.5 times higher than the rate for the general public. Wiseman says there are a few factors that contribute to that.
It's a statistic that's likely exacerbated by those experiencing financial instability and isolation. Like I say, farmers work alone. They spend long hours alone, isolate, feel the need to do it themselves, be strong.
Wiseman says there can also be a stigma for getting help. She says that's why a collaboration with Cornell, the mental health nonprofit Rural Minds, and New York FarmNet wants to prepare more people to navigate conversations around mental health, especially for the folks who are more likely to be around farmers, like veterinarians or other ag-related businesses. She says the free hour-long course reviews the warning signs that a person is struggling. Wiseman says it's things like noticing if a person's appearance or behavior has changed recently.
Are they not going about their daily routines, such as if you know Farmer John goes to the coffee shop every morning at 7 o'clock and he's not there for a few days, reaching out to him and saying, hey, what's, you know, I missed you. He's probably busy, but being attentive to when a person changes their behaviors.
Wiseman says the key is reaching out to neighbors and being willing to ask questions and listen. She says it could be one of the most important things that we do.
It's always important to never be afraid to ask somebody, have you thought of hurting yourself? Have you thought of suicide? Because what happens is many people, they won't talk about that because they think if they ask that question, that will automatically have the person act on their thoughts, which is just the opposite of what happens. When you ask somebody, they're relieved that somebody can actually put words to what they're feeling and open up the discussion.
Wiseman says the online course is open to anyone, whether you work with farmers or not. She says the goal is open to up a conversation and to help community members feel less alone. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text the National Suicide Crisis Lifeline at 988. In Canton, I'm Catherine Wheeler for the New York Public News Network.
Former President Jimmy Carter died this week at the age of 100. The Legislative Gazette's Ian Pickus spoke with the Schenectady historian about Carter's connection to New York's Capital Region.
As the nation pauses to remember President Jimmy Carter, the loss of the longest living president is being felt in the Schenectady area, where Carter spent some pivotal months long before embarking on a political career. In 1953, Carter and his young wife Rosalyn were stationed in military housing while he studied nuclear physics at Union College. Carter had been tapped to work on a new atomic submarine program. 2 decades later, while running for president, the Georgian briefly returned to campus for the only time during the New York primary campaign. Joining me now for more is Schenectady City historian Chris Leonard. Thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
How did former President Carter wind up in the Capital Region?
After graduating from the Naval Academy, later to be President Carter, was tapped by Admiral Hyman Rickover, who was the father of the nuclear navy, to go specifically to Schenectady, to Union College, and to be part of the Knowles Atomic Power Labs in West Milton, which would later become the Kenneth Kesselring site. While he was in Schenectady, he was taking classes at Union College. He was training NCOs, and he was working on the engine and the preparations for the second nuclear submarine, the Seawolf, that was being planned.
What was the city like as he would have encountered it at that time?
Well, Schenectady in the 1950s was really at its full peak. Population over 100,000 people, General Electric in full sway, Alco doing very well. And it was a busy city with a lot of commerce, a lot of things happening.
What do we know about what Carter's life was like while living in Schenectady?
Well, he lived on Duanesburg Road here in Rotterdam, which was in military housing. He was here with Rosalyn and three young children, and he looked back on it as a happy time because he was doing a job he really liked and was greatly respected for, and his family was thriving.
He didn't stay here very long. How come?
He was here less than a year. He did extraordinarily well at the Knowles Atomic Power Labs, and it looked like he had a bright future in the military. His father, Earl, passed away in 1953, and Earl ran the family's peanut farm, which was about 5,000 acres in the small town of Plains, Georgia. and it employed about 1,500 people in that small town. So Jimmy had decisions to make. You know, was he going to stay career military, or was he going to go down and take over the family peanut farm, which he eventually decided to do?
Did he retain any sort of connection with the city or its people in the years after leaving?
Yeah, he did come back in 1976 when he was on the campaign trail and had a stop at Union College, where he touted his time here and said that he always considered himself one of you, meaning part of the Union family. He was an extraordinarily intelligent man. And he got out of the Naval Academy, graduating like in the top 10% of the class. And also all of this training that he had in the nuclear field, that he, you know, the graduate work he was doing at Union College, came to play during his presidency with the Three Mile Island accident. So it was being explained what was happening at the plant at the time of the failure. He understood it, so he could embrace it and speak to it and work to get the right people in the right place to do the right things to make sure nothing, you know, really exploded down there.
To what extent is President Carter's time in Schenectady remembered today?
Well, those of us who tune into presidential history, we do remember his time very well, and especially those who are interested in local history. As for commemorations, there is a plaque outside the home he lived on Duanesburg Road commemorating his time, his short time that he was there.
We've been speaking with Schenectady City historian Chris Leonard about the short time that former President Jimmy Carter spent living and working in the city. Thank you for breaking it down for us, Chris.
Happy to do so, Ian.
The Legislative Gazette's Ian Pickus. And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. Look for program number 2501. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Happy New Year. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.